I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak with you this afternoon. What I'd like to talk about are lessons that I think I have learned in the last 20 years in the use of genomics, in particular molecular markers, in breeding for complex quantitative traits. As Mark mentioned, I got my degree from the University of Illinois, and this was back in the mid-1980s. Now, plant breeding can be defined as the science, art, and business of improving plants for human benefit. And when I was younger, I thought that plant breeding was quite simpler than it is today. Well, what I learned from school is basically you cross something good by something that is also good, and you hope for the best, and you select based mainly on the phenotype, what you observe, what you see out in the field or the lab or the greenhouse. Now, I still remember the day when my co-grad students and I first heard of restriction fragment length polymorphisms, RFLPs, which you don't hear too much of today. I think back then it was even called RFLPs. This article, review by Beckman and Solar, indicated that the advent of RFLPs, by greatly increasing the total number of polymorphic markers available to the agriculture community, may signal the advent of a new and promising era for two things: the understanding and the improvement of quantitative economic traits. And I thought, in hindsight, it was quite significant that they mentioned those two specifically and separately, the understanding and improvement. Now, if we fast forward to how things might look like today, at least in large, aggressive breeding programs as exemplified by commercial maize breeding, we know for sure that there have been at least well over 1,000 studies to map quantitative trait loci. I don't know what the latest count is, but we know that it has been more than 1,000. There have been easily more than 1,000 quantitative trait loci, or QTL, reported in plants. In this day and age, in large breeding programs, you could argue that there are cheap, if not cheaper, and abundant DNA markers, all the way down to single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. And at the same time, with increasing costs of fuel and labor and land and so on, phenotyping, the process of obtaining phenotypes, has gotten more expensive. So when we look back, comparing mid-80s to today, what have we learned? What are some things we have learned? Well, for one thing, I think we have learned how to find QTL and how to do that quite well. If you look at the literature, this was back from a review I did already 5 years ago, and it's outdated by now. But if you look at the number of QTL detected for a trait, it has ranged from one or two to over 20. This was for plant height in maize, where a study detected 36 QTL for that trait. If you look at the percentage of the phenotypic variants explained by the markers or the QTL, they range mostly from 40 to 60%. And the percentage of the variants due to each QTL follows this distribution, where you could conclude, or at least argue, that quantitative traits are controlled by fewer loci with large effects and a larger number of loci with fewer effects. Now, you could ask, well, what have we done, or what has happened to all of these information? Where have all the QTL gone? And I have had my share of QTL mapping experiments, and I'm sad to say that much of it has remained in journals or in publications, but have not been exploited or utilized in actual breeding. So what might be some reasons for that, for the lack of exploiting of QTL that have been discovered and whose effects have been estimated? I'd like to share with you this afternoon five practical things, and again, it's a biased list, that we've learned from looking back at the how markers have been used in breeding for complex quantitative traits. First is that, and this is a quote due to Randy Shoemaker, for really complex traits, it's easy to detect a QTL, but much more difficult to detect the same QTL twice. Not that it cannot be done, and we see many examples of that being done, but it is much more difficult to validate a QTL once it has been detected. Second, I think we need to know, before embarking on any QTL mapping, we need to know why do we want to detect QTL in the first place. What is the purpose? And because the purpose for detecting QTL would dictate the approach and the germplasm that we would be using in the study. I think we have learned that it pays to exploit markers when other methods are less effective. We need to consider gain per unit cost and unit time, and not just gain per generation or gain per cycle, but we do need to look at cost and time. And fifth is looking a bit more into the future, can we actually do marker-assisted selection without QTL mapping? And I think the answer is yes. Now, if we look at the consistency of QTL effects, I think this has been a main hindrance, if not the main hindrance, to using QTL information. Of course, if the germplasm, if the same QTL or if the same genes do not segregate in the same in different germplasm, we would not expect to find the same QTL in different populations. Yet, even in repeated studies, repeated mapping experiments with the same population, researchers have detected a certain lack of consistency of these effects. And there are several reasons that have been cited. One is sampling. It's purely a sampling issue when studying limited or finite populations. And because of time, I won't be able to go into detail, so although there is quite a bit of literature showing this, particularly for plant height in maize. Second is the presence of genotype by environment interaction. Obviously, if we expect genotype by environment interaction for the trait phenotype as a whole, we could also deduce that we would expect QTL by environment interaction, and that could contribute to a lack of consistency of these effects. Bill Beavis, back in 1994, showed that when population sizes are small, that there is an overestimation of the magnitude of QTL effects, which again can lead to a lack of consistency in the estimates. And fourth, it has been shown in simulation studies with the typical population sizes used in mapping experiments, that the confidence intervals can be quite large, up to 20, if not more, centimorgans. And so again, the point that I'm trying to make here is that this inconsistency has hindered the exploitation of QTL, although, as I'll show later on, there are quite notable examples to the contrary. A second lesson that I think we have learned is we need to know why do we want to find QTL? What's the purpose for that endeavor? You could argue that one purpose is to increase our biological knowledge of the control of a complex trait. Or you could be a bit perhaps more on the breeding or breeding side of it, and you would want to introgress or introduce a single QTL or a few QTL to your target germplasm. Or if the trait is really complex, you might be more interested in selecting for multiple or for many QTL simultaneously or at the same time. The fact of the matter is that depending on the particular reason you want to find QTL, the things that you would do to detect QTL would probably differ. In other words, if for different purposes, there could be different ways. For example, if we are interested in selecting or manipulating QTL at many loci, for example, for grain yield in maize, the most practical application would be to look at the most elite germplasm that is present in the breeding program. If you're looking at traits controlled by few QTLs, such as, for example, insect or disease resistance, where you have a unique source of resistance, you might be looking at perhaps not the most elite germplasm, but not the most exotic or diverse germplasm as well. However, if you are looking at increasing true biological knowledge of the control of the trait, you could argue that you ought to be sampling as diverse germplasm as you can so that you have a good representation of the allelic diversity that is present in the species that you're studying. Now, the approach could also differ. For example, for a trait controlled by many QTL, you could probably adapt a linkage mapping approach where you would grow an F2 or Bacross population, phenotype it, genotype it, and find marker trait associations. Now, if you're interested more in biological knowledge, I would think that you would need to go from linkage mapping to actual candidate genes so that you would have a good understanding of how these candidate genes act as well as interact with other genes. If we are looking at many QTL, it has been found that in quote-unquote mapping, it actually pays to have quite a few false positives or a not very stringent significance level for detecting the presence of QTL and using that in selection. For example, Fred Hospital found that a significance level of about 30% would be recommended when trying to find markers associated with a complex trait such as grain yield or grain moisture in maize. However, if you would like to, say, clone a QTL, you better be sure that that QTL is present, and you would like to minimize as much as possible the presence of false positives. So again, the way you go about doing things would depend on what you are after. There are examples of successful use of molecular markers. For many QTL, one is so-called marker-assisted recurrent selection that is now routinely used in maize. There are examples in wheat for fusarium head blight resistance. Jim Anderson's group, my colleague at Minnesota, as well as soybean cyst nematode QTL. And as far as getting more biological knowledge of the actual genes, back in 2000, Steve Tanksley's group at Cornell was able to clone a QTL for fruit size in tomato. Okay. Now, in a breeding program, there are several general aspects that I'd like to start by reviewing. First of all, a breeder would have to create a new population upon which to do selection. Sometimes the new population is subjected to some sort of population improvement. This is mainly for cross-pollinated crops where recurrent selection is done. In self-pollinated crops, it probably goes straight from a new population to inbred development, where the cultivar or the variety would be an inbred line. And for hybrid crops such as maize, there is this extra step of trying to develop hybrids. So again, the concept being that you have this flowchart or these different phases in a typical breeding program for just about any plant species. And again, some might be present in other species and some might not. Now, if you look at the types of information that is available in each phase, you can break it down in this way. For example, a new population is created usually by crossing two inbred lines, sometimes more than two inbred lines. But these inbred lines have a certain pedigree structure. We know what the parents are, we know what the grandparents are, we know how they are related amongst each other. In hybrid development, it's the same situation where there is a fixed pedigree structure, whereas here, during either population improvement or inbred development, the breeder usually selects within that given population. So for example, a breeder might choose two inbreds, form an F2, and then the selection population improvement and inbred development would be within that F2 population, where there really is no pedigree structure, or in other words, you have a uniform pedigree structure, or you are dealing with a single pedigree. Now, I don't have the time to go into details, but we've shown that best linear unbiased prediction is useful in this first step of creating new populations, and this last step of choosing the best hybrids that are available. The reason why BLUP or best linear unbiased prediction is useful is because there are pedigree structures that can be exploited. So in BLUP, the pedigree structure and the available information from relatives is exploited to come up with the best choices of creating a new population or developing a new hybrid. However, you can't really use BLUP in this middle section over here because there is no pedigree structure that you can take advantage of. So in that regard, because BLUP is not useful in this phase, it turns out that I believe that molecular markers then are most useful in this phase of the breeding program where there's no pedigree structure to take advantage of, and therefore molecular markers could potentially offer the greatest advantage in increasing the gain from selection. I think it's of less value here in hybrid development, and I think here on top for new populations, I think this is still subject to further study, because we can't predict the mean of the new population just using BLUP, but to predict the variance within that population, we would probably need other sources of information such as molecular markers. So again, the lesson here is that markers have a greater potential in some aspects of the breeding program than in other aspects of the breeding program. Now we need to look at number four, gain per unit cost and per unit time. Just a review of maize breeding. Again, it's a pedigree breeding structure. You cross inbred one by inbred two. The breeder obtains self-families. Because it is a hybrid crop, it has to be crossed to something else, a tester, so that its hybrid or test cross performance can be evaluated, and then new inbreds are developed. So this is the old or the traditional pipeline or methodology in developing maize inbred lines. What has become common in the last several years is marker-assisted recurrent selection, where there's a short detour here after test cross evaluation, wherein marker trait associations are identified, and then selection is done based on jointly on phenotypic information and marker information. The progenies are then sent to a warm place like Puerto Rico or Hawaii, where 2 to 3 generations of selection just based on marker information can be done. So in a warm place like Puerto Rico or Hawaii, you could grow up to 7 generations in 2 years, or three or 3.5 generations per year. So the idea being that the marker, although the phenotypic data or phenotypic information in Hawaii are not relevant to the U.S. Corn Belt, the DNA remains the same, and therefore the breeder can make decisions just based on marker information. So instead of having one cycle of or generation of selection per year, a breeder can have 2 or 3, and therefore that is a way of speeding up the breeding progress or increasing the gain per unit time. So a timeline could be like this. Again, in May to October, yield trials, and then it's sent to Hawaii where recombination is done. The seedlings, DNA is extracted from the seedlings. The information becomes available before flowering. Selection decisions are made, and up to 3 generations of selection just based on markers is done in 1 year. Dick Johnson from Monsanto presented this summary of some of the things that they've done within Monsanto. And so they've shown indeed that in generation, the first generation from cycle 0 to cycle 1, these are different F2 populations, and the thick line shows the mean across populations. There was a gain of 9 bushels per acre. The gain was halved by the second generation, but it was still nevertheless a substantial gain. And again, this being accomplished, you're gaining about 13, 14 bushels per acre just in 1 year, which is a significant amount of progress. And if you look at the cost, if you argue that to get good phenotypic data you need 5 locations and the cost is $20 per year, the cost of phenotyping would then be $100. However, if you do it on a large scale and with SNPs and at the cost of, say, 7 cents per data point, the cost of genotyping that one entry is now $36. And so here we have a different a shift in the playing field where phenotyping is now a more limiting factor than genotyping. And so how would that change the way we do things? And later on I'll share some ideas. But as I've talked to different maize breeders in the industry, they unanimously agree that to them phenotyping is now the bottleneck rather than genotyping. The last thing that I'd like to present is the idea, can we actually have marker-assisted selection without QTL mapping? And this is a subject of some of the recent research that we've done in my group, and it's called genome-wide selection. It was introduced by Mi Wissen back in 2001. He's an animal breeder, originally from Norway. It takes advantage of cheap and abundant molecular markers. It circumvents the need to identify significant markers. And instead, what it does, it estimates the value for each marker. Now, for example, in marker-assisted recurrent selection, the procedure was to look at the genome and to try to identify at a relaxed significance level genomic regions or markers that are significantly associated with a trait, as denoted by these ovals over here, meaning that selection will be based on the joint effects of these markers. An effect will be estimated for each one, and those effects will be combined in an index that would then be used to rank the different candidates. What happened, so here I think I have illustrated about 18 significant regions that could be used in marker-assisted recurrent selection. What happens in genome-wide selection is that this step of first identifying significant markers is circumvented, and instead an effect is estimated for each of the different markers in the genome, meaning that if there are 500 markers used, all 500 markers are used in the selection process, and an effect is estimated for each of those 500 markers. So for those markers that are in reality close to an underlying locus, you would expect a non-zero effect, whereas for those that might not be linked to a true locus, a quantitative trait locus, you would have an effect close to zero, and then you have all the effects in between. So again, the idea is just to genotype everything, all the progenies with all the markers anyway, and use all the markers in selection. So it's a quick and dirty brute force kind of approach. So we've studied potential gains by computer simulation from genome-wide selection, or GWS, compared it to marker-assisted recurrent selection, which relies on significant markers, and comparing it to one generation of phenotypic selection. So one generation of phenotypic selection would get under a heritability of 0.5 in a population size of 96, a gain of about 1.5 standard deviations, and that would take 3 years. With marker-assisted recurrent selection, you get a gain of about 2.7, whereas with genome-wide selection, you still have a diminishing response with different cycles, but you do achieve a larger gain of close to 4.0. And so the point here is that this takes 3 years from 0 to 1 with aggressive use of off-season nurseries from cycle 1 to cycle 5. It could take only a little over a year. Okay. Some key results for genome-wide selection. It is consistently superior to marker-assisted recurrent selection. It works best when the heritability is low and when there are many QTL controlling the trait. And you do need a minimum number of markers for it to be useful, say about 256 markers for the different situations that we've studied. How does this compare with other approaches? Genome-wide selection. Well, here I tried to separate the process of gene discovery and selection in elite germplasm. So procedures such as comparative genomics and association mapping tend to focus more on the gene discovery aspect, and not so much and less emphasis on the selection. With genome-wide selection, the emphasis is truly in selection in elite germplasm. However, the data that are generated in genome-wide selection can also be used in the traditional QTL mapping, and again, because the data are generated in the course of genome-wide selection. So again, to recap, these are some things that, and it's a biased list of things that I've learned in using markers in a breeding program. And some closing thoughts. What I've talked about mainly has been the use of markers in the selection process. However, that presupposes that there is a sufficient amount of genetic variation that is created, and we do need to create new genetic variation, and if not find new genetic variation, with the help of markers if that variation is not initially present. Second, when I started my career, I first actually started working with a seed company before coming to the academe. The question back then was something like this. Given the current methods for breeding crops, how can molecular markers best be used in a breeding program? I think technology has developed to the point that we can actually delete that first part of that statement, and we can simply ask, how can molecular markers best be used in a breeding program without necessarily conditioning it on how breeding has been done in the past? And as you could see, efficient use of molecular markers in a breeding program would likely require a concerted, coordinated effort. And I think in the last few years, the different CAP projects, or coordinated agricultural projects funded by the USDA, there's one for rice, there's one for wheat, there's one for barley, and the latest one, which is really impressive, was for conifers, are designed to achieve the use of molecular markers in an integrated way to improve complex traits. And I happen to be part of the Barley Coordinated Agriculture Project. This is a group of 30 investigators looking at a bunch of traits, about 40 traits, looking at SNP markers using breeding germplasm and developing databases and software to move to look at both genes and traits, but not stopping there, but actually using that to develop improved germplasm. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and do we have time for questions?
Thank you, Rex. We have time for a few questions.
In genome-wide selection, the markers are assumed as random rather than fixed, so that I think in a way that deals with some of the collinearity problem. But the bottom line is we really don't bother with the collinearity because we're more interested in how the model, that particular model, performs for that population, as opposed to, we're looking at the model as a whole as opposed to the individual effects.
Yeah. Other questions? One question I had was, when you're using BLUP to choose your parents, it seems like kind of a closed system, so once you've chosen the best parents, you really have no choice except to keep going down lower and lower in the rank, right?
That is right. So with the issue with using BLUP is, are you going a certain direction, so to speak, in terms of your germplasm and your germplasm diversity? And I think there is truth to that, and that's why in the end I tried to point out that yes, we do need for practical purposes to focus on elite germplasm, but there's much to be said about using other more diverse sources of germplasm, for which you might not be able to use BLUP in that sense, but you just target other sources of diversity using other criteria.
Okay. Yeah. Other questions from the audience? If I could just ask one more question. Maybe it just escaped me. On the whole genome selection. It seems to me that even though you say that the genome-wide selection is best for low heritability traits, it seems to me like you're still going to fall into the trap of needing to evaluate these traits in multiple environments in order to be sure that the heritability and the accuracy of your and the quality of your markers is good enough to make progress. So if the G by E and heritability is so low, right, you're really just chasing an elusive target out there.
That is right. You need good phenotypic data to come up with anything. But I think the idea was, so you want to estimate, you want to build your model, so to speak, when heritability is greater than zero. But the actual application, say in Hawaii or Puerto Rico, effectively your heritability is zero, mm-hmm. because the phenotype is not meaningful. So, yeah. But yes, in terms of the actual gain, it depends if you express efficiency as a difference as opposed to a ratio. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the actual gain, it's better if you have a higher heritability.
And of course, that's going to change for every population.
Right.
Every population is different.
Right. And so with genome-wide selection, the idea is to do this for each population separately.
Okay. Oh, there's one question there in the back.
Right.
What happens when you have a crop that has multiple, perhaps numerous traits of interest?
Okay, so is there, are you talking about everything in general or more a specific?
Well, you can say the same thing, you're talking about sweet corn. We're worried about flavor and appearance of the ear and husk protection.
Yeah. I think it boiled down to how a breeder would handle multiple traits in the first place. So, for example, with genome-wide selection, you could have genome-wide selection predictions for each trait individually, and then the breeder can look at each trait, and depending on how he or she handles multiple traits, make the selections accordingly. Or predictions could be made for the multiple trait index itself. So both ways are possible. But again, it boils down to, well, in the first place, how do breeders make selection decisions based on multiple traits? And then the application will follow how that is done by the breeder.
Okay, we need to move on. Thank you very
much,
Rex.